You are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Steeder.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, March 12th, 2015. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the three-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, from the Uber blog, Hullabaloo, Digby, a.k.a., no, I guess it's Heather Parton, a.k.a. Digby. Nevertheless, to talk about Obama learning to be liberal. And I have a feeling we'll make our way through some emails and a questionably secure server and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Also on the program today, Ayatollah Khamenei mocking the United States' decline to the extent that we can no longer pass an agreement and have a stable transition from government to government. Also on the program, Bush in chains. You should pay attention. The dollar is getting too strong. Another failure by the Secret Service. It is odd that the Secret Service seems to have fallen apart during the Obama administration. Unions drop the hammer on fast track. They're going to withhold donations. Just a bizarre story of a Republican congressman from Arkansas who apparently not only rehomed a couple of girls that they were going to adopt, but did so only after putting them through multiple exorcisms because they were possessed. Well, I mean, you know why you do an exorcism, right? Because they're possessed, as opposed to you being completely clinically insane. What's that?
I said, I actually didn't know this morning, and you helpfully pointed that out to me.
You just thought that people did exorcisms because, as if it was like exercise.
I thought it was a yoga thing.
Of course you did.
What's the big deal?
Folks, a little house cleaning, in addition to my daily ritual now of asking you to vote for the Majority Report at podcastawards.com. And let me just read you the IM from Lawyer Matthew. Your vote has been verified, is the way that he tells me every day that he has voted and his vote has been verified. Because once you vote at Podcast Awards for the Majority Report as the best news and politics podcast, and also, while you're there, vote for Best of the Left as People's Choice. You put your email in, and then they verify your vote by sending you an email. Sometimes that gets into the spam filter. And then you just got to click on it, and that's it. Your vote is verified. So I've done my duty in terms of telling you that. Also, housekeeping, tomorrow will be a special edition of Matt and Mike Friday because I am finally going to get that colonoscopy. And I realized that, you know, once I say it on the program, it doesn't occur to me that it's not something that I shouldn't bring up in the course of other conversations. So I've realized like it's probably not appropriate, but I've, you know, people have asked me like, oh, can we meet on Friday? And I'm like, no, I'm getting a colonoscopy, when I could probably just say I have a doctor's appointment.
Let me be clear.
Yes.
About the
I'm going to send you photos.
Why.
But and so I'm beginning my regiment of like liquids only. And one of these days, maybe on today's better half, or maybe I'll do this next week, I will tell you the saga of the whole anesthesia. I'm now sort of like immersed in this, and my insurance company wouldn't cover the anesthesia, et cetera, et cetera. This whole system, our whole medical system, is such a mess. It really is just bizarre. But more on that later. Let's take a quick break. A reminder, it's your support that makes this program possible. If you have the financial means to become a member, please do. If you want, and what we do is as a reward for supporting the Daily Show, we give you an extra 50 minutes. Many people, I think, many of our members, supporters, I think sometimes will skip the interview and just go to the fun half. I know, many may be a bit of exaggeration, but I've definitely heard that.
Some.
Because sometimes you just need to laugh or watch Michael try to...
What?
Right.
You're actually attempting to...
No.
Go at me over impressions or something?
So if you have the means, please become a member. And if you don't and you want access, please send us an email at majorityreporters@gmail.com. Because
sometimes you just need a laugh.
Well, we'll work on that.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we will. All right, I'll take a quick break. When we come back, we'll be talking to Digby.
Driving on nine. Shadow beneath the street light behind my home, driving on nine. I sure miss you. Past the motel, looking at the pines, driving.
We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. It is always a pleasure, ladies and gentlemen, for me to welcome our next guest to this program. She is the 2014 Hillman Prize winner, the proprietor of one of my favorite blogs. She writes at Salon.com, Heather Digby Parton. Hello, Heather.
Hi, Sam. You can call me Digby. Everybody
Digby. I know. Sometimes like there's like just a slight hesitation, and I am on an all liquid diet now, and in preparation for my big day tomorrow, which I've overshared with people, and so I think that's affecting my ability to sort of land on your name, but Digby. You wrote a piece about this interview that one of President Obama's longtime advisors, Dan Pfeiffer, gave to Jonathan Chait at the New York Magazine or at New York Magazine. Jeez. And you wrote about that. And I have to say, like, I am a little bit annoyed at how little attention that interview has gotten. But let's save that for a moment. Tell us about that interview and why it's relevant to folks like you and I.
Well, it was conducted with Dan Pfeiffer, who is one of, you know, President Obama's longtime advisors and associates going all the way back to the 2008 campaign. He's left, you know, for greener pastures. I mean, I think all these advisors burn out after a while. He's been there for a long time. And by all accounts, he's very, very close to President Obama. So I have to assume that he's not just, you know, speaking out of turn here, that he's someone who had great access and insight into the inner workings of the White House. And in the interview, it was actually rather shocking to me that we finally had somebody sort of admitting what had happened and showed some actual awareness of how this had happened. And essentially, this is what it was. They said that, you know, he admits they came into office with this idea that they had a special talent for reaching out and achieving some kind of bipartisan, transpartisan agreement with the Republicans. And they could, you know, they felt that the problems in the past had been part of some, apparently a part of some, you know, other dynamic that they were going to be able to overcome. And so they believed that they would be able to reach some kind of agreement with the Republicans. And they worked very hard at it, very hard at it, as as we all recall. They managed to pass a health care bill with not one Republican voting for it. They barely managed to pass the stimulus bill, which was, you know, essential to keep the country functioning. But for whatever reason, they came back out of that still thinking that they were going to have to, you know, they were going to make some headway with Republicans, despite that particular thing that had gone on in the early days. And that's when, of course, we all followed this story, Simpson Bowles, and they were going to have the grand bargain and we're going to, you know, they did all of that. And of course it didn't work, as right. We all know. And in fact, it ended up putting something on the menu that was actually very destructive to Democrats in general. And again, we'll see how that works out down the road. In this interview, he says that it took them that long to figure out that Republicans weren't operating on some kind of, you know, grand strategic basis. That basically, you know, John Boehner doesn't have a long game. He's just trying to get through the day, which I think was clear to all of us who were watching it from afar. There didn't seem to be any plan, not to mention the fact that, you know, it was clear that no matter what Obama did, they were going to oppose it. And this seemed to be clear from the very, very beginning. Now, apparently during this whole period, There were advisors in the White House, many of whom came from the Clinton administration, and they had learned this lesson that you had to appeal to the middle, that you absolutely, you know, that the base was irrelevant, that, you know, no matter what was going on, you had to, you know, work hard at not alienating the great, you know, independent, real Americans out there. And at some point after the, I think it was after the 2012 election, the Obama administration apparently decided that that wasn't such a great idea, and they started going for a more unilateral approach with, you know, carrying the base and trying to actually initiate liberal policies. Now, he says that that happened after 2012. I think it was actually after 2014 where we've seen the real action on that, because, I mean, maybe a little bit after 2012, but it was because they hedged on the immigration thing before 2014, as you recall, and then afterwards immediately went and did it. But the idea being that he said that they decided that worrying about that didn't make any difference, and says whenever we contemplate bold progressive action, you got hemming and hawing in advance about what it was going to mean. Is it going to alienate people? What will it mean in the red state? And then he says, and yet this, it's always proved overblown, quote, there's never been a time when we've taken progressive action and regretted it. Well, I read this and I thought, oh my God, because, you know, those of us, people like you and people like me, and those of us who've been observing the dynamic for the last, you know, too long, last, right, you know, for a couple of decades, there was nothing new in this. I mean, I was really taken aback by the fact that the liberal, the progressive base that was out there knew this from the very beginning. We'd been observing Republicans being, you know, insane for a very long time. There was no indication they were ever going to do this. And in fact, they were ever going to cooperate with Obama. And in fact, during the 2008 campaign, one of the more annoying aspects of the Obama, pitch to the public was he had this, you know, special ability to do this, which seemed absurd to a lot of us. You know, we were kind of saying, now, wait a minute, that's not going to work. You were voted in as a progressive, an unabashed progressive in the minds of your followers anyway.
Right.
And certainly on a symbolic level, I think no one would have been surprised to see Barack Obama be a progressive president. And yet you think that you're going to be able to come in and change the entire dynamic of Washington by your mere presence. That's not going to happen. And what you need to do is just take, as Dan Pfeiffer says, take unilateral progressive action. And had he done that, they would have not regretted it. So anyway, that's the substance of the interview and why I was taken aback by it, because it's the first time I've heard anybody indicate. I mean, you recall Robert Gibbs, who was the former press secretary, he was so very dismissive of what he termed the professional left any time that we would kind of go, hey, guys, you know, this isn't working and you need to stop doing this stuff and wasting a lot of time. And, you know, when you go back to that 2011 deficit reduction grand bargain negotiation session, that was a real low point. It was a real low point. And it basically stymied whatever, at the end of the day, it stymied whatever forward progress we had made in terms of any kind of domestic policy. And a lot of people suffered for it. I've never heard any member of the administration admit, at least quite that boldly, what a mistake that had been.
You know, it's the interesting thing to me about it, I mean, there's so many different ways to sort of read, you know, and we can't obviously get into Dan Pfeiffer's head, and we can't get into the president's head. And maybe at the end of the day, it doesn't matter. Like the fact that he is assessing it this way is really, at the end of the day, the only thing that matters. I don't know if I totally believe it. I mean, but to the extent that I do, in other words, he's saying, look, we made some tactical mistakes, right? I mean, ultimately, that's what he's saying, it seems to me. We made some tactical mistakes. But I'm not convinced that they're sort of like strategic goals weren't what they were going, you know, that the tactics might have been a mistake, broadly speaking, in terms of politics, but I'm not convinced that their strategic goals were necessarily aligned with progressives in the same way. And maybe that's irrelevant to a certain extent, just because, look, if it's being assessed this way, really, you know, at this point, we're just like, how is this going to implicate things going forward, right? I mean, and that's the real issue, I guess. But I mean, do you think that he's being do you think it was just a simple matter of this is where we work tactically, or maybe the difference split here is that and I've, you know, I think maybe you referenced this in your piece, but I've heard people say, like, you know, the bottom line is that there was a sort of Clinton apparatus that existed, right? Like for years leading up to that election, people thought it was going to be Hillary Clinton. And by people, I mean, you know, the Washington sort of you know, people referred to the Center for American Progress as the Clinton administration in exile. You had this whole Clinton apparatus. And when he became president, he just basically adopted that, much to the chagrin, I think, of us. But that it was still their lessons that sort of hung over the place in some way.
Well, and I think Pfeiffer even admits that. I mean, he says that the advice that he would get around town was that you had to
triangulate, basically.
Yeah,
or
triangulate, and that they adopted that. Now, you know, I don't know what their, you know, what their actual belief system was. I mean, maybe they didn't even have a strategic vision in that way. I do think that they came in with the idea. I mean, certainly everything that we heard at the time, they came in with the idea that they had a unique ability to deal with Republicans.
Right.
And you remember that was a big part of their pitch,
right,
that, you know, when he was in Springfield in Illinois, he, you know, sat in a room and gotten all this stuff passed with, you know, with Republicans, and how he'd gotten conservatives on the Harvard Law Review to, you know, come together and work with him.
He met with lawmakers and he said, the difference is you got me, type of thing.
Yeah, the difference is you've got me. And that, you know, he was very, you know, the idea was that it was something unique to him that was going to make this thing work. Now, did they believe that? It's hard to say. I mean, I know that over the years that I've written that it sure looked like they believed their own hype over and over again. And, you know, I was skeptical of it from the beginning, as I know you were, because we've been watching these, you know, the way that this stuff works, and that's just not the case. Now, Pfeiffer, in his interview, one thing I didn't mention, says that it's all about the incentive structure, and the incentive structure meaning, you know, when you look at, in the Republican case, the gerrymandering, the power of the Tea Party, the, you know, their media structure. I'm assuming that's what he means. He didn't get explicit there. He just called it the incentive structure. And I agree with that. I mean, there are a lot of reasons why people, you know, in Congress do things that have nothing to do with the personalities involved, or what, you know, like they always talk about, you know, Chip and Ronnie got together and, you know, threw down a couple of scotches and that's how they got deals done. I mean, that's just really kind of nonsense. I mean, there is a power structure. It works in a particular way. And we're in a period in which the, you know, the two parties have, you know, there's very little overlap ideologically between them, or regionally between them, or anything. I mean, this is like they are existing as two, you know, power centers that are kind of fighting with one another, essentially. And so, you know, that idea that you're going to be able to massage these, you know, rough issues is kind of ridiculous. But who didn't know that?
Right.
I mean, as I put in my piece, I'm like, look, what we were looking at when Obama came into office, we were looking at a period, an entire decade almost with Bill Clinton, where the right had pulled out every single stop on a political level to actually force him from office, even to the point where they impeached him over a kind of a nonsensical issue that they found to impeach him over. They worked themselves up into a frenzy. During that period, yes, there was still enough of an overlap between the two parties that they were able to, you know, do some legislating together. And Bill Clinton was extremely willing to do legislation with them, trade legislation, you know, welfare reform, a lot of things that they wanted. And in those days, there was still enough of a hangover of the idea that, you know, let's take a little bit of what we can get and then we'll move on to the next step.
Right. And in those days, you also still had people like Lincoln Chafee, for instance.
Yeah.
I mean, there was like a different species that existed at that time.
And don't forget, you ever people like, you know, Bob Terry and David Boren. And,
right.
You know, I mean, there was there were a lot of, you know, very right-wing Democrats that were still left in office. And, you know, that was then. And nonetheless, there was no doubt that the Republicans had gone crazy by 2000.
Yep.
They were willing to use whatever political lever they had, including, you know, their brother's the president. Elect, you know, the presidential nominee, his brother's political machine to get over the line, and the Supreme Court stepped in and gave the most partisan Supreme Court decision in history to install him in office. They, you know, and then they started a war.
Right.
You know, for no good reason. I mean, there was nothing in any of that that wasn't clear to people who were observing that there was something was different. There was no longer, you know, you weren't dealing with a party that was operating on a sort of a, you know, they had long-term goals. There's no doubt about that. I mean, they wanted to invade Iraq for many years. They wanted to destroy Social Security. There are a lot of things they'd like to do. But as far as they're having this, you know, this great, you know, 10-dimensional chess game going on, it was obvious that they were totally being opportunistic whenever the moment came that they could, you know, appease their base or, you know, respond to the incentives, as Piper puts it, that's what they were going to do. So I never got it, why anyone would think that you could just thwart that with some kind of, you know, I don't know, special personality that would enable all of this to fall by the wayside. Those incentives were obvious for a very long time, and they were being rewarded over and over and over again during that same period, from the early 90s to the point where Obama came into office. The right wing had built up this tremendous infrastructure. It was extremely powerful. It had led us into a war against, you know, at least half the country and most of the world's will.
Right.
And it had done it anyway. So, I found it very difficult to believe that they didn't understand that. Now, as to your question, whether or not this is all kind of, you know, trying to cover that up in some way and saying, well, you know, we were just kind of observing the tactical maneuvers and this is what we came up with. I don't know.
Right.
It was a big mistake. Let's just put it that way. I think it was a big mistake.
And what's even more important, I think, for going forward is that you have at least one person, one, you know, advisor close to President Obama coming out and saying explicitly, it was a mistake. It was a miscalculation.
Yeah.
And, you know, he sloughs it off a little bit like, we thought that there was a partner there in Boehner, but we found out that he couldn't deliver even when we were basically giving him the House. And I want to get back to that incentive structure, because Chait writes, many political journalists imagine that the basic tension for the White House lies between Obama's liberal base and appealing to the Americans at the center, who will be crucial for tipping elections. Pfeiffer believes the dynamic is, in fact, the opposite. The incentive structure moves from going after the diminishing middle to motivating the base. And, you know, I can see he claims that they sort of came to this realization in 2012. I'm not so convinced, right? I mean, they specifically punted the immigration executive order till after the election. They did come out, I guess, in 2012, and we want the American Jobs Creation Act. But 2013 budget, I think it was, had the change CPI, the cuts to the cost of living increases Social Security. I mean, that's why I think the sort of the timeline, as he's saying this, like I'm not quite sure I believe it. And you know, again, at the end of the day, it doesn't really matter, because certainly in the past, I'm just trying to do this calculation, less than 5 months, we've gotten, you know, not necessarily they haven't all been executed, but we've gotten from a progressive standpoint, from a liberal perspective, some pretty good things. I mean, net neutrality, I think that's something that's going to resonate for years and years to come. Yeah. I mean, we're still suffering under the Telecommunications Act in 96, as far as I'm concerned. Things like the deferred action that's been held up, but that's by no fault of the Obama administration. It's because of of a judge. There's you know, the pact with China, Cuba relations. I mean, it goes on. And I guess the real question then moving forward is A, well, there's a couple questions. I've been struck by how little, and you and I sort of like inhabit some of the same, virtual spaces online. How little attention this has gotten, right? Because for a long time, the notion of what Pfeiffer had said, if Pfeiffer said this 3 years ago, he would have been laughed at by a lot of people. And I'm not even convinced he wouldn't have been laughed at by Chait, frankly.
Oh, he would have been. Are you kidding?
Well, that's what's sort of fascinating is like, this is all presented like it's just another day in the, you know, in the neighborhood, and none of like, wow, boy, I guess I was really wrong on all the premises I've had for the past 10 years.
Mm-hmm. Oh, and how about that Green Lanternism, huh?
Yes. I mean, well, tell people what that means, because what that idea is, Green Lanternism, because we get this a lot when we say like President Obama can do certain things, and at the very least he can take certain positions, and then you're accused of Green Lanternism. What does that mean?
Well, it was, and I think it was coined by Matt Iglesias sometime back in the 2000s. I don't remember what specifically it was, but it was the idea that the president can magically get things done. Am I right? I
mean,
is it any more complicated than that? And this is, of course, they derived this as a complete illusion that the president has no, you know, and basically it had morphed in the Obama years, especially during this period that we've been talking about, where he was, you know, trying vainly to pass legislation with the Republicans. Those people who insisted that, you know, maybe that the president would be wise to use whatever levers of power he had, for instance, with appointments, with regulations, you know, many of the things he's doing now. And certainly by coming out with, you know, without equivocating about his progressive goals and trying to make the case to the public that this was what he was trying to do, and using whatever means available. And, you know, the president does have a whole branch of government to himself with a gigantic administrative apparatus that one would think could be put to use in periods when the Congress is in gridlock. That we were told, those of us who made that argument and progressives who thought that was a good idea, you know, i.e. what he's doing now, we're told that we were foolish, delusional people. The presidency is basically, I used to make this joke all the time on my blog, but, you know, it's just kind of a symbolic office, sort of like the queen.
Right.
You can't really do anything. You go to ribbon cutting ceremonies and give speeches, you know, about nice things, and that's about it. And that's basically what we were told for years, that the president had no power. And, you know, that all of you people who, you know, keep wanting him to do it and, you know, do it, saying, oh, he just needs to lead. You know, I don't remember anybody serious saying that. In fact, you know, it was kind of the silly, you know, mainstream press who would say stupid things like that.
Right.
These were, you know, I mean, the critique was that it was clear that the Congress was not going to do anything. And if they did, it would be terrible. Whatever it was they did would not be worth doing in terms of, you know, passing any kind of change. The best you could hope for was to keep the status quo until they sobered up. And so what the president needed to do was to use this gigantic branch and big administrative apparatus that he has to do other things and do what he could and make the case to the people. And we were derided as complete fools. And not only that, making the case to the people, by the way, is also a joke, because it's called the bully pulpit, which the president can't be a bully because, you know, he doesn't have that kind of power. He can't get up there. Of course, the bully pulpit was not about bullying in the way we currently think of it. It came about because Theodore Roosevelt said it, and bully was more like an exhortation, you know, a kind of a, you know, a cheerleading.
Right,
kind
bully
of thing.
On
you. Know, bully
you.
For you, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, so it was kind of a misunderstanding about the very essential meaning of the word, the bully pulpit, and what it was supposed to do. And, you know, those of us who thought, you know, if you can't get anything done, at least make the case. Because this is, you know, the president has a huge platform. He can talk about things. People do listen to him. And if they hear it enough, they'll absorb it. And this will become kind of part, it will be out in the ether, and it will become part of the way people understand politics. Somebody's got to say this stuff. And instead, all you heard was, you know, the usual nonsense that you hear on cable TV, you know, about appealing to the middle and the, you know, the real Americans. And,
what's fascinating about this, about with Pfeiffer, is that what he is admitting is not, I mean, put aside the fact that he says this is a mistake, right? He says this was a choice. And so this is really the part that I think is really sort of crucial for people to understand. And I wish it would there was even, you know, frankly, there's not, I mean, people have written about this interview, but I mean, you're the only person who has sort of written it from, you know, this sort of perspective. Pfeiffer is saying we made a choice. So if they made an affirmative choice to do X, which in this instance was to go and to negotiate and try and meet them halfway and this and that, you can argue that it was right or wrong, but it was clearly a choice. So it means that the other choice, and there could have been multiple other choices, were actually valid choices as well, at least insofar as, you know, maybe not strategically, people can argue about that, but there was another route to take. I mean, because the thing that we heard the most about in terms of Green Lanternism wasn't just a criticism about what you perceive will happen. It is a criticism of what you believe should even be attempted. And yeah, insofar as, like, there is no, I mean, the argument wasn't just that you're fantastical in what you think the results are going to be. It is you're fantastical and think that there's any other route to take here. Yeah. And so Pfeiffer's not only saying we made a mistake, but he's laying that essential foundation that there was a choice we made. We could have gone strategically one way, and we could have gone strategically or tactically another way. And we went one way, and that was a big mistake. And so it just it's such a huge revelation on some level, or I should not a revelation per se for but it is such an important building block, because, you know, I would like to see, you know, someone in Clinton world address this dynamic in some fashion, because it's not going to happen. I understand.
Well, I know, but you know,
that's Green Lantern. But
I mean, I wrote this at the end of my piece. This is really important, because I think people are going under the assumption that Hillary Clinton, of all people, understands in a way perhaps Obama did not, what she's up against. And that was one of the arguments for her in 2008. I don't know, you know, whatever. But I don't think there's any doubt that she's not naive about the nature of the opposition. I suspect she gets it. But what I don't know is if she has learned any of that other lesson about how, I mean, this is not the 90s anymore. There is no way to do that stuff the way, I mean, she's going to follow the pattern of her husband, and herself. I mean, she was in the administration too. How they handled that and how they approached that was to try and do exactly what President Obama tried to do, and it didn't work. And I have no clue whether or not she has learned that lesson and understands that this is now about base motivation. It is about rallying your own troops. It is about finding a way to do what needs to be done, understanding that you are not going to be, at least for the near term. I mean, Republicans, like I said, they may sober up at some point, but at the moment, this is just not happening. And as they are acting increasingly nuts, as we saw with this letter to Iran this week, you know, the Democrats are going to circle the wagons as well. So, you know, we're probably going to see some increased polarization, which is hard to believe it's possible, but I do think that's what's going to happen, which means that the president has a completely different task ahead of her if she becomes than President Clinton had during his time. And I have no idea whether or not that has penetrated in any way in Clinton world, and whether, I mean, maybe Dan Pfeiffer is sending a message, you know, hey guys, you know,
Right.
Wake up, because this has happened and you better know what you're getting into. But I don't know. And, you know, and until, you know, we're going to be talking about, you know, emails and other silly stuff rather than trying to find this out, I think. I mean, I don't know when we're going to be able to ask these questions.
Well,
so,
you know, I'll tell you something, this whole email thing, and I want to talk to you about that. And if we run up against the time, maybe we'll just carry this over into the second half of the program, because if you don't mind, if you have time.
No, of course not.
Because, you know, all of this Pfeiffer stuff is really important, I think, its greatest importance, of course, is to whether or not the next Democratic nominee president gets this message. And really, I think, you know, part of that person getting that message is also that the sort of center left, a machine to the extent that there is one, gets this message too. And it strikes me, you know, this has been such a weird sort of this whole email thing has been sort of fascinating in a couple of ways, because we never had with President Obama, I guess the closest that like anything like this came was Reverend Wright, where they were sort of besieged. But, you know, Reverend Wright was is a real guy who really said those things. They were sort of taken out of context. And I think, you know, for many people, I was like, oh, this is what I'm hoping for. I'm actually hoping that President Obama sat into Reverend Wright's pew and at the very least, absorbed some of what was being talked about here. And I think when he came out and basically said, you know, here is Reverend Wright, et cetera, like it deflated everything, because, you know, it's not like he's my hidden uncle. He's my, he said he's my crazy uncle, and everybody's got one, and here he is, and we invite him to dinner, and I listen to some of the things he says and other things not, whatnot. Ultimately, I'm not convinced that he listened to anything, but it is weird to me that the Clintons somehow, like, we've already got the first, you know, whatever it is, digital archive gate. And there's going to be multiple more of these. I think, you know, I have one theory that says that cable news will just like exhaust themselves and won't go down this this wormhole again. But maybe not. But I guess one of the things that struck me about all of this, and I was on Hayes's show talking about it.
Mm-hmm.
And frankly, like, I don't think there's that much such a big deal here. But I've also was sort of like, wow, they, you know, I it seems to me maybe there was a way for them to sort of nip this in the bud. And they didn't. But it also occurs to me, like, you know, the reason why it got so far with Clinton in terms of the impeachment, I'm quite convinced, is that the base of the Democratic Party was just not interested in defending him. And because he was not delivering for the base in the same way. I mean, I think people basically defended him against the sort of the excess of the Republicans. But, you know, I certainly am not motivated to go on there and, to go out into the world and, expend every bit of energy I can to defend the Clinton email non-scandal. You know, I'm just like, this is what it is. But I think, like, they still don't get that they didn't have that fundamental, flank covered. Do you know what I'm saying? Does that make any sense or no?
I do, but I don't know that they actually don't think they do. I mean, you know, like 538 just put out a, you know, some kind of a, you know, whatever they do, polling or, you know, some kind of analysis that showed that, you know, the party is still behind her 100%. Nobody cares. She's got, you know, I think that that's what, you know, ends up happening all the time is that, you know, I think you're right about Lewinsky. That was kind of a, you know, oh, my God. And nobody wanted to touch it, you know. It was just, it was iffy, and people didn't want to actually be in a position. It was a very difficult position to be defending somebody, but let's just put it that way. And so, I think they think they do have the backing of the Democrats. And I think, I don't know how strategic they are about any of this, but it's entirely possible. I think that they might think that there's a positive to it. It's kind of like, yes, the more they get beaten, the more, and especially when the right starts to go crazy and the press starts to act like, a bunch of One Direction fans, squealing daily about this stuff, that, the base then starts to rally around her. I don't know where they are. I mean, it's hard for me to imagine anybody likes this other than, I do see the right wing is very excited about it. Needless to say, that was the whole setup of Benghazi, right, was for this purpose. I mean, this is why, right, they have an ongoing committee on Benghazi, which has been settled. Even by the committee, it's been settled, but they're still doing it anyway, is so that they have an apparatus to issue subpoenas and, drop, leak to the press, these little things. And I mean, that's obviously part of what, that there really is a plan about this.
Right. Right. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think
Benghazi is a plan.
Definitely. I think that his name now is Gowdy. Gowdy's committee is just a scandal making machine. Yeah. Is basically
it's
a
like
fake.
Dan Burton's machine. Burton's committee was back in the 90s.
Indeed,
and obviously it still does work. The press gets very excited about this, and I wish I could explain to you
why it works with the Clintons and not Obama, because Obama has not. Is it? I wonder if it isn't like in some way that that the Republicans, when chasing scandal with the Obama administration, almost like couldn't help themselves but always gravitate towards somehow making it about race. You know what I mean? Like they couldn't.
Yeah, maybe that's it. Maybe it's really that simple.
And that is more, I guess, sort of like that sets off more alarm bells to the media, and they don't feel as comfortable pursuing the fact that he's not, really a citizen, or that it just makes the Republicans just too stupid. Like literally they keep gravitating, like they can't help themselves, but they keep sort of gravitating back to his race on some level. If that's why they couldn't get anything that would get even, they already have more traction on this email thing than they had on really any supposed scandal with the Obama administration.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's far more, and I could sense it from the beginning, and I actually wrote it. I went, oh, Benghazi's the one. But, the IRS thing, they love that because they were victimized by the big bad government, allegedly, even though they weren't. And, it's the IRS, and it's about taxes, and all that has a certain sexy currency on the right. But Benghazi, of course, from the beginning. In fact, I put, when I write it, I always put it with an exclamation point at the end and a trademark symbol.
Right.
Because it is a trademark, scandal. And, of course, the reason it works is because Hillary Clinton is attached to it. I mean, you can see people, even some of the old-time reporters, Andrea Mitchell, for instance. I mean, you can see that she kind of can't help herself following it. But at the same time, she's been doing a little bit of sort of historical backgrounding on this thing in a way that others aren't. And as you say, when you say, why didn't they get ahead of it? Mitchell did an interesting show yesterday or the day before. Going back to the famous pink suit press conference, which was about Hillary and the cattle futures and Whitewater and all this other nonsense back in the 90s, she came before the press. She sat down in some big, room in a chair, and the whole press corps was there, and they were looking at her, and she answered questions for an eternity. It was the longest press conference I've ever seen in my life. Every question was answered. By the time they were done, the press corps was exhausted, and everyone had said to her ahead of time, if you do this, if you just get up there and answer every question, if you just don't avoid it, if you just come before us and lay it all out, that will put an end to most of this, and we'll just carry on. What we need from you is that you face the media and answer every question. She did that, and the town exploded afterwards. There was, all it did, of course, was raise more questions. And
right,
as Andrea Mitchell points out, this is the lesson the Clintons learned. The more you give, the worse it gets.
Right.
So that is why I think they do not, they're not immediately forthcoming. There's not this, you know, there's always this sort of sense of, you know, why don't they nip it in the bud? How come this stuff is allowed to fester? I honestly think they believe that whatever they do, it's going to fester anyway. And if they feed it, it's just going to be worse. So, you know, put it off until you absolutely have to answer questions and then answer them. And then, you know, just wait for the next, for the, you know, tidal wave to subside a little bit and then carry on. I mean, this is how they've been conditioned to deal with it. And the press likewise has also been conditioned to do this. So, you know, it's like we're just getting, you know, we're in this pattern. I do have to point out one thing. It is the Clintons that seem to bring this out, and it's like this ongoing soap opera that's been, you know, I don't know. Boy, historically, this is going to be a very interesting period around them and, you know, how people look at it. But it also happened to Al Gore.
Right.
And, you know, perhaps that.
But that was because Al Gore had, you know, forgive the characterization, Clinton juice on him. Right? I mean,
well, there's that. Yeah, he did. I mean, he did, you know, and, but, you know, there were even, you know, aspects of this with Kerry. When, you know, they moved on the slip boat thing in a way that was just kind of insane. The press did. There was kind of a blood in the water feeling there that you sense it if you've watched it long enough, as you and I both have, that febrile kind of excitement where, you know, there's no longer any, it's a feedback loop in among the media where they're just kind of saying what each other is saying, and you can see it. It's home in cable news, but it also, you know, works in the media, in the press, the printed press as well. And you know, I think that there was a little bit of that with him too. Gore got it very badly in a different way. I mean, each of these has their own
right. Own
characteristics, but what it comes from, and this is what I think what the press needs to think hard about on this as they go forward with Hillary. It's not as if none of this is legitimate. And of course, it's a, you know, it's a congressional committee that's, you know, raising all these questions. I mean, you can't just ignore it. I mean, obviously it has to be dealt with. But, you know, there have been exposés of the Republican oppo research and opposition,
machine
apparatus.
Right.
Yeah, machine that they use. It's very, very good. It's very effective. In fact, two of the people who ran the machine against Al Gore are now, in government. Barbara Comstock is a member of Congress now, and Tim Griffin, who was sort of made famous briefly, he was in the Justice Department and was made famous briefly as part of the U.S. attorney scandal. He's now the lieutenant governor of Arkansas. Those two people ran the oppo shop against Al Gore. And there has been, you know, there was a documentary made about it, about how the press would call them up and say, what have you got for me? And how they would plant these stories with the press, with the idea of advancing them as these sort of, see, I mean, they're never really, it's never anything specific. It's about character. It's about how to show, you know, they build a character of their opponent. And then they feed the press these tidbits of information very systematically to build that caricature that they're trying to build. They did it with Kerry, you know, no doubt about it, the windsurfing, the whole thing. And so, you know, the press needs to be aware of this. And I have noticed in this latest one, what I'm seeing is there's a new generation here who don't know about this. New generation of reporters who, they don't know that this is how this stuff has worked. And they sort of took it for granted that this, quote, narrative about Hillary Clinton, that, you know, she's a Machiavellian control freak, you know, bad character. This narrative, they sort of launched right into that without recognizing what that was about. And I'm not saying it's wrong, but they need to at least know where it's coming from, how that works, the whole way the system is. And I'm a little afraid that there's going to be, you know, a big learning curve on this. And the sad thing is, Sam, is that, you know, we're going to do this stuff with Hillary Clinton. And if there's no opponent, and, you know, God knows, I don't see one on the horizon. Maybe, you know, Jim Webb is not going to get the job done. I'm sorry.
Right.
There's going to be no way to talk to her about this other stuff, this important stuff that we really need to have.
Right.
Out,
we're going to have an entire, to the extent that we have any sort of run up to the general election, and then even arguably in the general election, it's all going to be about emails and pantsuits and haircuts and what? Who knows what else? You know, Huma and the assortment of non-relevant things. It's a little bit aggravating. I mean, I'm starting to see now, you know, over the past couple of days, you know, these calls for a legitimate primary against Clinton for the sake of Clinton, really. And which is also is sort of strange. It's just such a strange era. And it's going to be fascinating, I have to say, on some level, too, to see if what happens when you have this apparatus that is led by a team that is still sort of, I guess, I mean, it just appears to me that they're still sort of like they're fighting the last war, right? Which was their, which was, I guess, in some level, the Clinton two-term presidency. But they just don't, there doesn't seem to have been like a makeover from 2008. You know what I mean? There doesn't seem to have been like, hey, this is a different media climate. This is a different, I mean, because there is. And it just seems like at one point they may have to make a sort of a, just make a sort of an a big decision internally. Like we've got to take a slightly different tact here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I
actually don't think that anything that we've seen is indicative of a weakness as a general election. I think she could win. I don't, you know, like you say, there's 80% still support her in the Democratic Party. I don't know that there's the depth there. I mean, that's, you know, one thing that I think is always very hard to measure. It's just like sort of how motivated are those 80%? You know what I mean? Like, it's one thing.
Well,
to...
I will say this. I think that women in particular, and you'll find this even among her greatest critics, among women, that, you know, there's a sense that, you know, if you want to see a woman president, this is it. There's no other woman who has the, you know, the resume, the gravitas, the whatever it is, you know, the charisma to become president. And so, you know, the Republicans are crazy, and even if they put up Jeb Bush or some other, you know, sort of, you know, what they think is some anodyne mainstream guy, they're not, and they have to answer to this craziness, and they will be crazy, and I don't think there's any doubt about it. That this is a time, you know, this is when you have your opening to get your first. They had it in 2008, and Obama won. Now it's, you know, going to be 2016, and you know, this is a time for the Democrats to advance this and have a woman president. The opening may not be here for a very long time.
Oh, yeah, I totally agree. And when I talk about the depth on that 80%, I'm not talking about from an electoral standpoint. I mean, I actually think that, like, if you've got a very strong relationship with the activist base, and by the activist base, I'm talking like people who really pay attention to politics, who are going to, you know, even if, I mean, if 100 people send, you know, emails to a, you know, someone who is opining about like, hey, you know, this is way off topic. That impacts stuff. You know, like I know that now. What I did not know 10 years ago when I started this is like, you know, yeah, these reporters, no, people don't contact them. If they get 100 emails, polite emails from people who sound reasonable and say, you're way off base on this, that's going to implicate their reporting. And I just think that, like, they don't understand that they could, or maybe they do understand, they just don't care, maybe because maybe there is some value to them to deal with this sort of, like, piddling stuff you know, I mean, certainly the Obama administration learned, like, hey, the longer we can get them to be talking about the birth certificate, the better. I mean, we should never show this birth certificate. We should come out with a fraudulent one just to show the first time, just to see what happens. You know, maybe that is, you know, the Clinton people feel like, look, there's nothing here at the end of the day. And let them chase these emails, because it doesn't matter. It does make it look like we're getting beat up over nothing. And as much as Washington is abuzz about this, you know, people outside who don't really pay attention to this stuff either way, they don't care. And but, you know, for people like us who really want to sort of start to shape the form of what an administration will look like, it's that much more frustrating.
Well, yeah, and it's exhausting. I mean, honestly, it's an exhausting process. You know, which is part of what they're trying to evoke is the idea. There was another idea they had, which was called Clinton fatigue, which was just, you know, God, whatever, you know, get her out. I think they're trying to provoke that feeling. That I'm talking about the right wing here.
Right.
And you know, I think the press kind of goes along with that. I mean, you tell me, you're in the media. Is part of this, is there an incentive in the media? Does this do good? Is this good for ratings? I mean, do people tune in because of this stuff? Is that really a? Because I don't honestly know.
You know,
we didn't have this when this happened before.
I don't know. I mean, my sense is just from like sort of casually watching MSNBC is that there is a belief there that it does. I mean, I walked onto the set at Hayes' show the other night, and the graphic was, you know, welcome to your next 20 months or something, mm-hmm. you know, and I was just like, oh, and there, you know, I think that's like I personally just don't think that there's the energy in the media to maintain this. You know, this is not the days of where CNN dictates the, you know, the narrative, and it's not the days where Fox dictates the narrative. It's the narrative is the ownership of the narrative is more dispersed these days, it seems to me, and I don't think it's going to be as easy to drive this stuff, frankly.
We're in a world that has just, you know, there's a lot of noise. I mean, you know, at the same time this email thing was happening, the Republicans were acting like lunatics and sending, you know, letters to the Ayatollah telling him, you better deal with us, dude, basically. And you know, there's all kinds of crazy stuff. I mean, look what just happened in Ferguson last night, and that's going to be a big story. So it's really, I think it's harder to control that storyline, because the world is, you know, the media now is much more, you know, as you say, the narrative is dispersed, and world events are much more immediate, I think, to people. So it may be more difficult to kind of to keep the energy going that these scandals really require. I mean, they kind of, you know, burst into flame, and then they would be able to keep them going for a while. Just, you know, here's a little revelation here, here's this, that, and the other. And I'm not quite sure they'll be able to do it. I mean, we're going to see, obviously. This is the way it's going to go. But I just am, you know, I'm sad in a sense, because, you know, what Dan Pfeiffer said is, you know, it's such an important insight. It's so important for people who have been working in, you know, in progressive politics. It was so hard won to come to that understanding. That, you know, we're in a new time. This is not about trying to split the difference or, you know, meet people halfway. I'm talking just on a policy level, forgetting the politics of it and, you know, whether or not, you know, Hillary has a narrative or whatever that else is going on. But just this idea that in order to affect actual policy that you know, it affects people's lives, that actually makes a difference in the way people live. You have to have an understanding of how this is working, and it's not going to be a matter of, I don't think that Hillary Clinton is going to be able to sit down with Mitch McConnell and hammer out deals.
Right.
That's not going to happen. So how is Hillary Clinton going to do whatever it is? And does she have an interest in doing the things that could make her a successful president and make progressivism a successful ideology during the period when she's in office. I mean, we don't know that. I mean, all we know about her so far is that she has been very cozy with Wall Street. Mm-hmm. Her foreign policy is way more hawkish than the base, at least to the extent that we know about it. And, you know, I think she'll be good on social issues. I have no reason to believe that she won't advance. I mean, I think she'll be very good on women's rights, which God knows is important to me. And I think that that's a real selling point. But, you know, this is an ideological package. It isn't just one thing. And you can't just say that, you know, she's going to be good on this. And so the rest of it should just go unaddressed. I mean, that's just ridiculous. And I don't know, you know, with no primary, and it, I've never thought there would be one because I thought that, you know, we had sort of made an unconscious, a collective unconscious decision that she would be the next nominee after 2008 because it was a close primary election. I don't know how this stuff is going to get hashed out. And I think that, you know, everybody's worried about, you know, has Hillary learned anything about how to deal with the press and is this all going to be, you know, can she handle her scandals? I don't know if she's learned anything about, you know, policy.
Yes.
You know, what does she believe about economics in America today, about income inequality, about how the role of government in dealing with that stuff? Because if it's the 1990s stuff, if it's the same old stuff that Bill Clinton believed, we have a big problem.
Yep.
That is going to fail. That is going to fail. It is going to fail on every level, political, policy, and all the way along. And we'll end up, you know, with a failed presidency and God only knows Tom Cotton for president in 2020, which, you know, they're clearing the way for him to run in 2020. You know, I don't know if you read that, but they're, it's against the law for a sitting senator to run for president in Arkansas. And they just changed the law in Arkansas so he could run in 2020. I'm not kidding.
Oh my God.
I mean, you know, oh my God, you know, so we can't afford a failed Clinton presidency. Let's just put it that way. We just can't. So,
well,
you know.
Digby, we're going to talk more and more over the next 20 months because it's going to be fascinating. That's going to be a fascinating question. And I think there's another question on the other side is, you know, is this going to be is this going to be the time where you start to see some of the, you know, are we entering into the era of Tom Cotton? Where they actually ascend, they no longer are just sort of, you know, the other guys on the podium, but whether or not they actually ascend. But Digby, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Sam.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, went a little long, but always a treat for me to talk to Digby about these questions. And it's going to head into the fun half. The number 646-257-3920. 646-257-3920 is the number. A reminder, folks, if you buy crap from Amazon, buy it through our Amazon link. Let's go to majorityreportkickback.com. Click on the Amazon link. Buy your Amazon crap through that. You will notice no difference. But we get a little tiny kickback. Thus, we call it majorityreportkickback.com. And if you drink coffee and you buy coffee and you grind it at home, or even if you like it pre-grounded, is that right? Pre-grounded? If you like it ground, justcoffee.coop. You can use it in your Keurig with like a little cup, like, you know, refillable cup like we do, or you can use it in your filter. Just grind it up, and you get 10% off when you use the coupon code MAJORITY. It is a fair trade coffee, not free, fair trade. Everybody gets a fair wage, and it's co-op-owned coffee company, I guess. That's why it's justcoffee.coop, C-O-O-P. And you can get the Majority Report blend, and it's a great conversation piece. You just leave the bag on your table when you have your friends over. On the coffee table, I guess it is, or on your dinner table. And they say, what's that? Oh, well, that's my Majority Report blend from Just Coffee. So you turn people onto the show and the coffee. 646-257-3920, or you can IM me via the app at majorityapp.com. Folks, it'll be Matt and Mike Friday tomorrow. I will give you the full report, obviously. on the colonoscopy on Monday. We'll be back in just a moment.